You're listening to the Tennis.com podcast. And here's your host, Ed McGrogan.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Tennis.com podcast. This is Ed McGrogan, joined today by a special guest, Colette Lewis. Her website, ZooTennis.com, is one of, if not the source on college tennis you'll find online. I know a lot of you who follow tennis closely probably know and have read Colette's work, but I wanted to get her on the podcast today as perhaps part of the piece you are reading today about last year's NCAA men's final. So, Colette, thank you, first of all, for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I'd like you to kind of introduce, really, because I think it's a question I had, too, is kind of what drew you to covering college tennis. You know, how long have you been covering it, and what's the appeal that you see in really devoting your work to it?
Well, I started covering junior tennis because of my home here in Kalamazoo, Michigan, where the boys' nationals are played. And I've been doing that basically my whole life. But once I started actually covering tennis as a reporter about 14, 15 years ago, I was drawn to kind of find out what happened to the boys after they leave here, after they've gone to the through the 18s, won Kalamazoo or done well here. And so it seemed like a natural progression to kind of follow them through college. In 2005, when I started ZooTennis.com, I went to my first NCAA men's team final. It was at College Station. It was 4-3. UCLA came back from being 3-1 down, and it was just one of the most exciting things I had ever seen in tennis. Not having seen very much team or Davis Cup, it was amazing, the excitement, the drama. So from then on, I was hooked. It's not often that you can pinpoint an exact time where something drew you in, but there was no question to me that that was something I definitely felt I had to be covering and watching after seeing that match.
You know, actually, it got me thinking, just talking to you now, seeing where the players, the juniors, go after playing juniors. And now in the Pro Tour, I think a lot of recent momentum has been, you know, many college players are making that jump to the pro game. John Isner's an obvious example. There's a lot of others, though. You know, what do you think actually about the preparation that college gives for the pro game? Is that something that you think this is a trend that you see continuing, you know, just to increase as time goes on?
I do think so. I was just talking to someone the other day about Blaz Rolla from Ohio State, who's the defending or reigning NCAA champion, who turned pro after his junior year at Ohio State, and now is up to, I believe it's 128 in the world. So at this time last year, you were watching a young man of that caliber play and occasionally lose in college tennis. So you can tell what the quality is. It's really futures level, challenger level at the very top for sure. So to me, I just think that to get the kind of competition you need without struggling financially, it's a very, very good option for 99% of the aspiring pros out there. It's just really difficult to pay your way. I know there's been a lot of talk about just the paltry money that's made at that level, how quickly you really have to get up winning challengers to survive financially. And college gives you an opportunity not to have to worry about that economic, also get great competition, grow up some, and maybe not least have a family kind of behind you. Once you go to college, you really do have a support network that extends forever. I mean, John Isner still has huge support wherever he goes in the world, if there are University of Georgia alumni there. And the same now with Kevin Anderson from Illinois. And so I think that's another important thing, to just really have a connection to a bigger institution that can kind of help support you in those early years when things are tough.
It's true, especially because of how, by nature, sort of a solo act tennis is, and just really it is a lonely game in ways when you're playing, and in many players' cases, like you're saying, just trying to get by, it's a very, as many of you know, difficult time there. Primarily one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is about UCLA and Virginia, who in this most recent piece, this oral history that we've done, including yourself, we've talked about this in obviously some pretty great detail. The piece, you know, leaves off with looking ahead a little bit to where these two teams go. They play for the first time since that NCAA final later this week. And I was wondering what really has become of the Bruins and the Cavs this year. Are there a lot of players remaining from these two final teams last year, or is it a lot of turnover? Just kind of maybe an overview of where these two teams stand now.
There's been a little bit. They've both lost their number ones. Denis Novikov of UCLA turned pro after his sophomore year, and Jameer Jenkins graduated from Virginia, and he's out in the top 300 now in the ATP rankings. So obviously there's that. When you lose the top two guys, there's going to be a little bit of change, but the two protagonists are back, although Adrien Puget has not played because he's had an injury. He is in school, but they're taking it very slow. So that's another issue as to whether he will be part of the match coming up. But Mitchell Frank has been playing number one for Virginia now after playing in the third position last year. UCLA actually has two of their players in the qualifying at Indian Wells right now today. Klay Thompson, who has been playing one for them after playing five for them last year, and Marcos Giron, who has been is a junior now and has been playing two for them for the last couple of years, occasionally one as well. So they're both excellent teams. They would both be among the favorites heading into the NCAAs in May. So I think this match is going to go a long way kind of to seeing if they can possibly top that last one. Certainly not, but mm-hmm. It's a very interesting kind of gauge at where the two teams are right now.
Yes, and if anybody here listening has not read the piece, sort of shame on you, first of all, but also, you know, Virginia wins the title 4-3, being down effectively title points and, you know, escaping in one of the most unlikely ways possible.
So, yes.
So like I said, please read it, and Colette, of course, contributes a lot to the color, setting the scene. She was at the final, of course. Who, you know, what are some of the other teams along with UCLA and Virginia this year on the men's side that position themselves, in your opinion, as title favorites?
I think it is pretty wide open this year. Ohio State won the team indoor championship, and they're undefeated. They have an amazing home winning streak going, which is now at 182 straight matches going back to 2003. They have not lost a match at home in Columbus, so that's amazing. And they're undefeated this year. It's probably not one of the very strongest teams that they've ever had, but they knew when they lost Rolla that they were going to have to get, you know, a team effort. But they did win the team indoor, so they are definitely a threat. USC, who won the four previous years prior to Virginia, is always an excellent team there to be considered. And there are probably four or five other teams that could pop up and do well. John Roddick, Andy Roddick's older brother, has a very fine team at Oklahoma this year. And Texas is very good. Georgia will be back in the mix. There's just a whole slew of them, and it makes it very exciting, actually. We've always had a few semi-prohibitive favorites, I guess, going in. And I think maybe UCLA would have been that had Puget been healthy. But since he hasn't been able to play recently, there's still some question, and they're not very good at doubles right now. So it leaves the door open to a very exciting tournament coming up.
I actually want to ask, along with the women's favorites, who I'd like to know, because we haven't touched on that side of things yet, I'd like to kind of get the same top-level perspective from you on the women's status right now. Also, I was wondering if you could explain to myself and to everybody else listening, really, just the overall schedule of how college tennis plays itself out each year. It's is it more seasonal each fall? Is it more fall? Is it more spring? It obviously ends in May, but what are kind of the main pillars of the college season and how it progresses?
Right now, in the fall is the individual season. There are two majors, one outdoor, one indoor, and all the tournaments are like all ATP and ITF tournaments, standard, 32, 64 draw tournaments with one winner. And a lot of the ranking information in that is generated from those two tournaments, and then smaller tournaments that are hosted, but there are two big national ones. Then beginning in mid to late January, once everybody's back in school, they start the dual match season where teams are playing each other, usually twice a week. Conference season is usually just getting started right now and extends through mid to late April, and then we start the NCAAs. But those are team events where you are slotted by the level of your ability, with 1 through 6 in singles, and then in doubles, there are 3 doubles teams that play each other for 1 point, and whoever wins the points, 6 singles points, whoever wins 4 of the 7 points available wins the match. And I'm assuming that, I hope people are a little more familiar with that if they've read the story, exactly how that works. But this is a team season that we're in right now. So that's the spring. In the fall is definitely the individual part of it.
Yeah, I was, it was a little bit surprising to me only to see how, the great disparity between all the amount of singles matches that go into the overall score and just one doubles match that really goes into it. That was one thing I noticed right away off the piece there. And even to the effect that the doubles match is played first before any of the singles match, it really does come down, I guess, to how good your singles field can be there.
Yes, it does. And yet it is amazing how that sort of sets the table for what's to follow. Obviously, if you've got very good singles, you can overcome the loss of just that 1 point. But it does give you a little bit more chance to maybe relax once you've already got that 1 point, knowing that you only need 3 more. You don't have to win 4 of the 6. So it does set the tone. It is one of the doubles is one of the things that has been sort of I won't say de-emphasized, but that's probably the right word in some of the format experimentation that's going on right now. And the college match days, which are being televised on ESPN3 occasionally, usually once a week during the season, are going with singles first. And doubles is only played then if the match is tied at 3-all. So far, there hasn't been a 3-all match. So.
Yeah, that is one. I think that was one story that got picked up a lot. I may ask you to kind of outline just when this experiment actually started or is taking place. I kind of compare it to how on the pro tour, years ago, there has been a lot of kind of wondering of what to do with doubles because of some concerns about the time it takes to play the matches, and in the pros, obviously it's a lot more geared toward what is kind of the marketability of it, what's its appeal. But I know that this was a big issue taken in college tennis, and it even got a lot of, from what I remember, it got a lot of attention directly from the teams, the universities, the players itself, like a really grassroots appeal to kind of, you know, save it, in effect, save the way the game is played. Am I sort of on the right track with that?
Yes, 2 years ago, the NCAA committee came out saying that there would not be a third set played. It would be like doubles is now on the ATP and WTA tour, that it would be regular scoring, unlike that, but there would be a match tiebreaker in lieu of a third set. That was not a popular choice, particularly with the players, I think. A lot of this is driven by just the fact that people believe that matches, which good matches do take usually 3.5 hours, sometimes even longer than that, but usually around 3.5 to 4 hours, if they're really, really good, really close. And so there's been a kind of a push, which was started by the NCAA committee, which is not the regulation body of college tennis in the United States. That's actually the ITA. So it makes it a little bit difficult, though I'm sure everybody who follows tennis is well aware of all the different alphabets that go behind every single decision. And that's the same in college tennis. However, that change did not fly. There was an uproar over that. They backed off. But then last September, the USTA said that they would do this ESPN thing, but under the format that they play singles first and doubles only if the match is tied at 3. So that's been another wrinkle. There's also with some other experimentation. The men went to no ad. The women tried the match tiebreaker in lieu of a third set. That was not popular. I think no ad has caught on a little bit. I think there have been less objections to that than to some of the other things that have been tried. So we're still right now not knowing. This year's NCAAs will be played as last year's was, but with standard scoring. And I think it's a tiebreaker at 7-all in the doubles.
Yeah, it's interesting that doubles is jumbled around from either, excuse me, almost being inconsequential in a way to being so pivotal. So we'll see where it goes.
Yes,
there.
Yes, exactly.
Last thing I wanted to ask is to go back, wanted your thoughts on where the women's college game is at the moment. And we only put it to the end here as we're kind of playing this off of our big men's piece. And I promise that if this year's women's NCAA final ends in as much excitement, controversy, we'll do the other end and give the lion's share to the ladies. So maybe some thoughts to close on where, what the status is of the best title contending women's teams.
Yeah, and we have had some really thrilling women's matches the past 2 or 3 years as well. But yeah, it's going to be extremely hard to top that UCLA UVA match. The women, again, there are a number of the usual contenders. Stanford, the defending champion, is very, very good. They do not play the team indoor, and so it's a little bit hard to determine how really good they are because they don't compete against the best teams until their Pac-12 season actually gets underway, which hasn't happened yet. So we haven't really seen, but Florida went in there, and Florida's another perennial, and those two have had an amazing rivalry over the past probably the last 30 years, but just some great, great matches since I've been covering it. And Florida went out to Palo Alto and got shut out, which is extremely unusual. So I think you have to say Stanford is really a contender. They lost their number one in Nicole Gibbs, who is a two-time NCAA champion. So they do have, you know, holes to fill, but they seem to always be able to recruit really great players. And Duke is number one right now. They won the team indoor. They have excellent team. There are UCLA, which is coached by Pete Sampras' sister, Stella, is an outstanding team. So I think, again, USC is very good, Virginia, North Carolina. There's going to be a lot of excitement again at the NCAAs for the women as well.
Colette, thank you very much for, I think, a lesson really in the college game to a lot of us here, myself included. And hopefully we can touch base again maybe around May for the NCAAs to kind of see how things shook out.
Okay, sounds great. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you very much. And thank you all again for listening to the Tennis.com podcast. I'm Ed McGrogan with Colette Lewis of ZooTennis.com.
You've been enjoying Tennis.com's weekly podcast. Thanks for listening. For all the latest news and events, head over to Tennis.com.